I think it's the business side, it's the operation side, it's actually knowing what to do after you close is where you make your real money.
Welcome to the Action Academy Podcast.
Stand back while I celebrate freedom.
The show where we help you achieve financial independence with the mindsets, methods, and actionable steps from guests who've already earned their freedom.
The flags of freedom fly.
Choose to do what you want.
What you want.
With who you want.
With who you want.
When you want.
When you want.
With another episode today. Now, here's your host, Brian Lubin.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Action Academy Podcast, the show that helps you get rich, happy, successful, and free with a capital F in your life and business. If you've been listening to this show for over a year, this next guest does not need an intro, but if you're brand new to the podcast, which a lot of you are, then I will give my buddy Logan Rankin the proper introduction. Logan was working a corporate job in Wisconsin, working for Target, and he worked his way up the ranks, became a VP of operations for Target, and was making a good bit of money in his W-2. Then he started buying multifamily real estate and eventually was able to leave that job. And fast forward to today, and Logan is almost netting $1 million a month. Netting. $1 million a month. So Logan's got a little over 3,000 multifamily units in his portfolio that he owns 100% himself, a little over $425 million valuation on that real estate. We did the math in today's podcast episode, and if he buys no new assets, does nothing, and just simply keeps managing and increasing and improving the properties he has today, he will be a billionaire at 44 years old, so in 10 years. So Logan is 1,000% in the game of buying, operating, and buying businesses that are related to multifamily. So long story short, when a guy like Logan gives you a call on a Monday and says, "Hey man, I've got some time free Thursday. Why don't you come out and tour my office so we can make a full day of content in Wisconsin?" You don't argue. You just cancel your calendar, you book a plane ticket, and you fly to Wisconsin, which is exactly what I did to sit down and do this interview today with Mr. Logan Rankin. So I flew on over, and what the result was for all of you for 100% free, no plane tickets, no relationships, no nothing. You guys get 3 hours of podcast content and an hour long video of Logan doing a mock presentation like he would present to a bank for funding him on a new project. So I'm obviously going to divvy this up throughout a couple of podcast episodes. So this will be the first of 4 episodes with Mr. Logan. Throughout this series of podcast episodes, you guys are going to learn how to go from zero to basically building a billion-dollar org chart. He walks us through every single system, procedure, and process he does in his business, how he goes about hiring, how he goes about managing SOP creation, how he keeps all of his multifamily units in-house, his ideas on partnerships, his ideas on operators, why he thinks seller financing is not a great idea, actually. So this is a very wide-arcing, wide-ranging conversation. And I will say one thing before we get going. This was both of our first times recording an in-person podcast, so we had lavalier mics clipped to our shirts, and so the audio quality isn't as great as you would normally expect, so please sit tight through the audio quality. It's good enough for you guys to get the content. So you're about to get $1 billion worth of advice on business operations, systems, hiring, org chart, multifamily, and life advice. I'm not asking that you guys reimburse me for my plane ticket, for my hotel. All I ask is simply if you leave us a rating and a review, 5 stars, if you enjoyed today's episode and share this podcast with one person that you think would find value from it, it would greatly be appreciated. Now, without any further ado, Logan Rankin, part one.
What's up, buddy? Oh my God. Logan Rankin, welcome back, man. This is going to be awesome. Round two. It's been over a year. We're at like a year and I think a couple of months since our last podcast episode. Now we get to do one here in person at Focus Property Management Group in Wisconsin for my brothers up north. So, man, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. I appreciate you coming here.
Dude, I was telling you at the beginning of this where it was just like before I didn't want to go out and travel and go all around to actually do this. But I was like, for you? Yeah, I'll come to Wisconsin. Who is Logan Rankin today in 2023?
Awesome. So last time we talked, last June, right? So I had 1,900 units. So I have 3,064 today that I own 100%. I have another 80 that I own 50-50 with my president of the property management company. So across 3,000, which is pretty cool. I have about 350 under contract right now. So I should finish the year over 3,500, 3,600. So it's been growth has continued. And I'd actually tell you, from 1,000 to 3,000 was way easier from 0 to 1,000. So it's interesting that we want to talk about that today. I feel like every apartment acquisition, reposition has been easier than the last, and especially when you have the systems and the people. So property management just crossed over 100 units, just launched a foundation, and I'm continuing to build the hold cold business, which invests in other businesses and takes advantage of our systems and strategy too. So that's where we are today.
We talk about this, you begin with really strong systems and really strong foundation, a really strong vision and team. And now it's gotten to the point where you said, you even told me 5 to 7 years in the making, now it's just a volume game. Yeah. Now there's a very clear path to the billion. And you see this over and over again with people that are operating. They're like, we built the systems, we built the infrastructure. Now it's just more of the same.
Yeah.
So I think where a lot of people are having problems and struggles with today are building the original team, building the original structure, building the original systems, building the original vision. So I ask people for questions to ask you, and over again, it's the same question. They say, I've got 3 to 30 doors here in 2023. These interest rates are going crazy. I can't find multifamily to save my life. I don't even know necessarily which asset is the best to support the cash flow for me to even leave my job and begin doing this full time. So what's advice that we can give to that person that's, they've got their foot in the door, they're in the game, they're trying to just like really get that cash flow so that they can leave that six-figure job and really focus full-time on building this team?
Yeah, I love that question because I do think there's been a lot of appreciation over the last 10 years, like you said. And actually, my media team and I just did a projection, and my total assets in the Rankin Holdings is about 4.25, $425 million, and at a 64% LTV. So we did the math. If I don't acquire another thing, that by age 45 or 46, that in a quarter should be worth $1 billion. So that's a big advantage. But to your point, what happens if you're starting out now and you're trying to grow the 3 to 10? What would you do? Honestly, I would do a lot of what I did still 10 years ago. And I do think there's going to be a lot of inflation and a lot of growth and a lot of ability to use debt and leverage to your advantage. It is more expensive now. Don't get me wrong, but there's also less competition. So I guess the first thing that I would do is I would actually get to know how to operate the real estate. Like, I think we want to skip that. Like, when I started, I mean, it took 3 years for me to buy 7 units. 3 years. I didn't buy a 70 unit right away. I didn't jump into a syndication right away. I didn't ask for 8 different partners to be able to buy. I saved up my money, right, by being good at my current job, my W-2 job, because if you don't have enough skills to earn enough money to acquire a single family investment or a duplex, you probably aren't going to have the skills to be able to grow your real estate portfolio.
That's a good point.
So figure out how to accumulate enough money to buy your first property. When you buy your first property, you don't have to property manage it, but whoever you hire to property manage it, you want to learn as much as you can so that you can understand how to operate that single family house or that duplex or that 4 unit, anything between 3 to 10 units. Because if you understand how to operate at a small amount and you have all the risk because you own it yourself, you also get all the reward. So if you can figure that out on a triplex or a 4 unit, then try an 8 unit next, right? Then try a 16 unit next, because every property, in fact, the bigger you get, I actually think it's the safer. You got a duplex, you got a vacancy, it's a 50% vacancy, right? You have a 100-unit apartment, you have one vacancy, it's a 1% vacancy. So I think when you're starting small, or if I were investing today, I would try to make sure I had enough money to be able to grab a property 100% myself, and then I would learn and educate myself with how to operate it. And I just don't think a lot of people do that right now. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they want the easiest way possible to be into real estate. You and I were talking about this a little bit before, but there's a lot of seller finance talk right now, right? And that's really attractive because seller financing is a great way to be able to get into a property. And when you seller finance a deal or a business, right, there's people talking about, can I seller finance and get into a business, or can I seller finance none of my own money? That's great. And I've used seller financing a lot, and creative financing is really fun. But if you don't know what to do after you sell, yes. That's really hard to be able to grow your portfolio. And I think it's the business side, it's the operation side, it's actually knowing what to do after you close is where you make your real money. Mm-hmm. And I'll share that. You want me to share that story with you?
Yeah, absolutely.
I was sharing a story earlier. I had a friend call me, and he's all pumped because he's buying this service business. and it comes with 14 people. And he's like, oh, I think it's a really good buy. I don't have to put any money into it. I was able to figure out how to negotiate and get creative financing. He's like, what do you think? And I'm like, you've never ran a business before. You've never had a leadership position before. You don't know anything about this certain business. All you know is what it potentially was cash flowing and that it has 14 people. So I guess my question is, how confident are you after the person that was running it, that's selling you this business, leaves, you can continue to grow this business? Because the real money is taking the business from 14 people to 40 to 400 to be able to grow that. What I was concerned about is he had no clue what to do with these 14 people. He didn't understand how to build a system. He didn't understand compensation. He didn't understand as simple things like payroll. Now, you can pay people to help you with that, but he didn't even know where to start. So all of a sudden, you acquire this business, and now your 14 people start leaving. Like, an integral person of that business leaves because you didn't know how to lead them or compensate them or properly incentivize them to grow the business. Mm-hmm. And you can't pay the seller financing notes. So I think it's like really popular right now to talk about creative financing and to buy these things with none of your own money. And what I'm getting at here, to back to your 3 to 10, what's not popular is doing the work. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter if it's 2013, 2009, or 2023, you still got to do the work. And if I was going to grow my portfolio all over again, I would start with doing the work. Like, after you buy the property, do you know what the hell you're doing? Because it's okay if you don't know right now. But if you start slow, you have your own money at risk, you're going to have a better probability to be able to learn those things, or at least learn the people that can help you out.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you say that, because the conversation always goes back to rock stars, right? So we hear about like the term rock stars thrown around, and in the business buying world, and which basically this is like, we'll go ahead and call this a capital B business conversation, because we can throw around multifamily cap rates, all this stuff, but we're just talking about operating a business within the real estate container, right? That is multifamily. So it's the same concepts. So when you're talking about this, everyone says, whether you're buying a seller finance service business, a laundromat, a car wash, or a multifamily property, we want to have that rock star operator, right? That grizzled veteran that's got the experience. Maybe they've been in that business already for 5, 10, 15 years, and we want to keep them on. But the paradox is, the rock star is not going to work for someone or work with someone that isn't also a rock star.
Yeah.
So it's a catch 22. I really want to talk about a specific person, because lately I've been having a lot of conversations with these people, and they're really fed up, stressed out, and pissed off about their optionality today. And a lot of these people are high performers. They're six figure, between 150 to 500,000 that normally listen to this podcast. These people have maybe $60,000, $80,000 saved up, right? Yeah. They've done the work. And they maybe have one property, two properties, three properties, and they're saving up and they're waiting for a year, 2 years to buy that next single family rental, to either Airbnb out or do something.
Yeah.
And they're getting beat in the market over and over again by cash offers that are coming out of these properties. And now they're throwing their hands up in the air and they're saying, look, like, I've got to replace $300,000 here for my job to even think about hitting this financial freedom thing.
Yeah.
Like, what the hell am I supposed to do? So I would immediately partner with somebody that has already been there, done that, got the t-shirt through networking, and then build the skill sets alongside them in that first deal. Maybe it would be like a 12 unit or a 30 unit to grow alongside them. But you were more so doing it on your own. Yep. So is that still what you would recommend? Or would you recommend partnering up with someone that has that knowledge that you can learn it faster?
I think those are a lot of good questions. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with partnerships. Like I said, the president of my property management company, I have 80 units. I'm about 80 units together, 50-50. So I think there's a lot of value, but it really depends on what you want. So if you're listening today and everything is about speed and you want to grow as quick as possible, it could be totally worth finding somebody that has either the experience or the knowledge that you can then hook up with, as long as you learn. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm seeing a lot of people want to take shortcuts, so they want to trade off of somebody with experience and knowledge, but they never learn. I see a lot of syndicators that got into this business that knew where the money was, but had no idea how to manage or operate. You don't have to actually manage or operate, but you have to be dangerous enough to know how to implement the systems or hold people accountable. Mm-hmm. So, and through partnerships, you should learn those things. Like, we were just talking about that. In everything you do, you can pay somebody or partner with somebody, but it shouldn't substitute you not learning, or at least becoming dangerous enough to be able to hold them accountable or ask the right questions. And I'm seeing a lot of people that are in partnerships or syndications that don't even know the right questions to ask. And that's really dangerous. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't want to do it, if you wanted to do it a little slower, I would say to not partner because, and mine was slow. The first 3 years, I would recommend slow so you actually know what you're doing. But then after that, then I think there's a great place for creative financing. If you understand what you're doing and you know when you acquire that property, you don't have to put as much money into it and you actually know how to reposition it, that's exactly what I did to start going faster, right? Instead of buying a couple properties a year, I started buying apartments and bigger apartments. And I didn't do that with all my own capital. I do just some of that through seller financing. And I did some of that through honestly just running my properties better. But you said the guy that has 3 to 10 properties, like how does he scale or how does he go quicker? The first thing I would ask that guy is, let me see your 10 units. Mm-hmm. And I want to see how you're running them. Are they fully optimized? What is your LTV? What is your debt service credit ratio? Is there value and money that you can pull out of those 10 to be able to buy the next 10? Because if you're doing a good job and you bought right, like you could be sitting at a 50% loan to value and have 30% equity to be able to pull that out and be able to buy the next deal too. If you didn't, and you're still sitting at a 70-80% LTV because you didn't grow NOI, you didn't understand how to operate your properties, or you didn't push the property management company, don't worry about buying the next 10 properties. Worry about how do you make the first 10 as passive and profitable as possible. For all my properties, I want to make sure they're fully optimized that way before I buy the next one. Because if they're not, you buy another 10 and your first 10 are still like all fucked up, not the way you want to be. Now you got a lot of headaches on your hand.
Mm-hmm. Right? So just putting a Band-Aid over a bullet hole.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's interesting. It's interesting how you think about things, because it's just like you go about things one way and other people go about it the other way. So it's just, it's cool to see there's really a million ways to make $1 million.
For sure.
It's just, you really have to go about the way that's best for you and truest to you.
Yes.
And so what I think you really thrive at and what you brought to the table in the very, very beginning was your operational experience from Target. Mm-hmm. And you were used to coming in and viewing things from a business perspective. And I feel like that's the bottleneck that a lot of people have, is they keep thinking of themselves as an investor. And I would challenge people, think of yourself as a business owner, even if you're doing your first unit or your second unit, think about it like a business. And because you did that, you were able to really build that core, like you said, 5 to 7 years of systems and structure that were able to support like what you have today.
Right.
So let's talk about business architecture here and the business ecosystem, because this is something that you excel at. And if you have a zone of genius, it'd be this. So let's talk about your first couple of hires and growing your business ecosystem to where it can actually support this.
Yeah.
Because your focus on structures and KPIs is next level.
Thank you. I think one of the best things that you can do to be able to grow your business, we're talking about rock stars. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of people say this, like they'll talk about like, man, like I've been so successful because I hired on all these great people. I'm not going to talk to you about that today. I do have some great people. But if you think that you're just going to hire this rock star and they're just going to train like this, let's say you don't want to know operations, you hire this awesome like COO and it's going to completely transform your business.
I think unicorn.
Unicorn, 100%. You want to create a business and a system and architecture for the average person. And maybe through your training and through your development, they become a rock star. It's much easier to do. And instead of searching for the unicorn, you build the best system possible for a normal person. There's much more of those to be able to hire. And if you build the system that way with small amount of KPIs, right? One to three. First thing I told you is every one of my team members has only 1 to 3 KPIs, never 4. Mm-hmm. Right? Because you also want to keep that really simple. Even rock stars can't drive 10 different KPIs to an elite amount. So why would you assume an average person can? So like everybody in a company has those 1 to 3 KPIs, and we're walking through our office and just talking to random people, right? An engagement specialist whose main job is to answer phone calls and pick up customers as they come in was sharing her KPIs with you. But business architecture starts like you asked my first few hires. The first person I hired was the president of my property management company, because I knew I wanted to force myself to, as you would call it, zoom out and be able to work on my business and not in my business. There's no doubt when you start building your business that you're going to be working in it, mm-hmm, 90% of the time. But that 10% of the time is super valuable for you to be able to work on it and be able to zoom out. And one of the best things that I always challenge my team and myself to do when you're building business architecture is you never design a system for a person. You design the best system to be able to grow your business in the future, and then you find the right person for that system. So most entrepreneurs screw this up, right? They're starting small, just like we did. You have four or five people, and you build the systems for the four or five people and the 250 units that we had. Wrong. You have to build the system for the 250 units you currently have, but then you got to zoom out and be like, where will I be in 3 years? Oh, 3,000 units. So you want to build the standard operating procedure and the business architecture, which is the roles and responsibilities that you will have as a company for 3,000 units, and they still work at 250 units. Like right now, there's not a single standard operating procedure that we upgrade as a company that is not built for 20,000 units. So if it doesn't work at 20,000 units, we're not using it at three. Because if you're constantly upgrading SOPs, this is something that most people forget. That means you're constantly changing the training of your team, and the things that they're doing on a day-to-day basis is inefficient. Mm-hmm. I read this in a book and it said that it takes 3 of the same months to hit peak efficiency. You want to know why most entrepreneurs don't give up responsibilities? It's because when they give up responsibilities to somebody, they don't do it as well as they do it. Mm-hmm. But they're never going to do it as well. You need to be at peak efficiency, which is probably 80% if you're lucky, 85% as good as you can do it. You got to be fine with that, by the way. You got to be fine with that. Let the other 15 to 20 go. But most times they're only at 50. You want to know why? Because you suck as an entrepreneur because you haven't trained them or developed an SOP and given them the time to be efficient. So why they have to do it 3 months is because today is the last day of August. So August is almost over. So if I hired a new team member to operate on a system for this month, they are not going to be 70 to 75% efficient until they do August of next year. Unless they're like a superstar, but I don't look for unicorns. That's the second month. Now they'll be at 70, 75%. You want to be at 85%? It's the third August. So when you're scaling, like our property management company is 4 years old. Started with 4 or 5 team members, and today we have 100. We have less than 10 people that have seen 3 seasons, 3 of the same months, right? Mm-hmm. So, and then on top of that, how many times did you change the standard operating procedure for that person and the responsibilities that they had? Like when I talk to a lot of business owners, whatever that person, let's call this person Megan, whatever Megan was doing today, this last August, a year goes by and the next August, half of her job's completely different. And that's the fault usually of business architecture and systems. You weren't thinking about where your business would be a year from now, let alone 5 years from now. And because of that, you're changing the responsibilities of a team member so much that it's really hard for them to be efficient and effective at their job.
Dude, I love that you're saying this because I'm guilty and I love learning from you because everything. So we did an interview like a year ago. And I try to bake everything into what I do. It's like how you're saying it. Like I showed you my 3-year. We hear a lot about SOPs, and to some, it comes easier than others, right? We have the book Traction by Gino Wickman. And it's got your visionary and your integrator, Rocket Fuel. Yep. And then the visionary, I almost feel like we use it as a crutch to a degree, because for me specifically, I'm like, okay, I'm really great at having this big idea and bringing in energy and creating a vision that other people can fit within. And then we all collectively groan when we hear the word SOP. Mm-hmm. And it feels like a personal hell. Yeah. How can we change our relationships with SOPs?
I think it goes back because most people that aren't excited to integrate an SOP, and by the way, nobody really is. I think they're lying to you if they said that they just love to work on SOPs and anyway.
Yeah.
And I do. I love the operation side of things, but I would hate my life if all I was doing was working on SOPs. So I think it says with what you start with is, I think for most people, you got to understand how to create the vision, mm-hmm. right? So I think you just got to pull back for a second and take a look at like why you want to create it in the first place, which will maybe give you more energy for that SOP. Because most, like I hear a lot of people say, I can't create an SOP. Yes, you can. You are doing an SOP. And you got to ask yourself the right questions, because the only reason you need to make a standard operating procedure is because eventually you want to take those responsibilities off of your shoulders. And you want to feel confident enough to be able to take those responsibilities off of your shoulders and give them to somebody else so they could do them at a fairly high degree. To my point, at least 80 to 85%. And I think most entrepreneurs that don't create the SOPs are also the ones that don't delegate. And the reason they don't delegate is because they do something like this. They don't create the SOP and they just give the responsibility to somebody else. And then they think that somebody else should just do it right. And then 3 months go by and they're like, wow, this team member's a piece of shit and they haven't done anything right. So one of the reasons...
Me! Rip me apart.
I think to change the relationship, you just think about it that way, right? Like, I want to create this process that's going to give me so much confidence that the person is doing about 85% of the stuff that I need them to do. And the best SOPs, everybody forgets, right? Let's think about the hard part. Just slow it down for a second and be like, okay, I don't want to do this thing anymore. Mm-hmm. I had to do delinquency at one point in my company. That's got to be one of the worst things, right? I had to do delinquencies and collections along with my president. I don't want to do this anymore, right? I can't do this anymore because I need to focus on, let's just say, acquisitions. I see that acquisitions make me more money, but yet I continue to do delinquency. Okay. So the first thing you do is you were doing it, right? By definition, before you create the SOP and you give the role and the responsibility to somebody else, you had to be doing it. So you don't have to overcomplicate it. What you should really be thinking about is, so what was I doing? And can anybody else do this? Because if they can't, then you just think about, is there a different way to do it that's easier for somebody to do? Mm-hmm. So you go through the steps. That's step one. Just literally write down. I know this might be the most painful time. You just write down all the steps that you were doing with delinquency. Step two, you ask yourself, can anybody else do these things? And in my case, delinquency, yeah, like I wasn't doing anything complicated. Like, so what is the most complicated that you think somebody could get wrong? So maybe it was like the conversation that you can't script. Okay. So what is the emotions that you want the person on the other side of the phone call to feel? Then just write those down. Because now you've created a step, but also you can teach somebody that, hey, you want to come across empathetic, but also know where to draw the line and they feel that there's accountability there. Okay. They can figure that out. So you go through and you write down all the steps. Anything complicated, maybe you write down the motions. Now, this is really important because this is why entrepreneurs take back that or see things are going wrong. The last two steps, number one, is you have to make the result visible. Before, when you were doing it, you didn't need to report shit. You were doing delinquency or you were doing the social media thing. But now you need to come up with a scoreboard, is how I call it. So in everything we do in a company, there's got to be a scoreboard. So you decide, all right, if this person was doing a really good job day to day, week to week, and I had no idea if they're following the standard operating procedure I just said, I don't want to dig into it. The last thing I want to do is micromanage this person. The result would be this. Sometimes there's one, sometimes there's two. This is where you get the KPIs from. Mm-hmm. And then you tell that person, I want you to make this report every Friday and send it to me. So with delinquency, we always want to be under 1%. So what do I want to know? I want to know what percentage, no matter how big we are we at the end of the month? If 1%, I feel fairly confident that they're probably following the SOPs or I didn't screw up my standard operating procedures. And if we're over 1%, guess what you can do? You can dig into and see what step or what are they going to do differently. You can even take it a step further and say, when you send the scorecard out, tell me one thing you think you're doing really well and one thing you can improve on. So besides just writing down your stuff that you were doing so somebody else can follow it, step two is you create a scoreboard so that you can feel more confident not stepping back into delinquency or whatever you're doing, but you can see the improvement time in and time again. Mm-hmm. Okay. Last thing, and step three, is when you do create that scoreboard, in my opinion, one of the best things that you can do too is you can tie that to compensation. And that doesn't necessarily have to be in our company. We have, you know, different areas of the company where we give monthly bonuses or different things like that, but it can just be for pay. Just be clear with the person. Hey, I just want to let you know, like, if you're under 1%, that means you're doing your job. That's where you should be, right? You're going to get an average review. But if you're underneath 0.8, that means you're kicking some ass. Like, that means you're doing a really good job, which means this is what the pay scale is going to look like for you at the end of the year. And if you hit 0.65, that means you're doing better than me when I was doing delinquency. And holy shit, that means I'm going to put you here. Because it's so the last thing that I think any good SOP does, you want them to be under 1%, but why do they want to be under 1%? Why do they want to follow the SOPs? So tie it back to the incentives. That's the only three things that you have to do. And if you think of it that way, it's, oh, wow, I just wrote down, I just want them to do what I said I'm going to do. There's going to be a scoreboard every single week, so I don't have to have anxiety about where are we. And I've been through this too. Like when I handed off leasing, because I like to sell, I had so much anxiety of, are we going to close these leads? Like, we need to close. Like, Like, it's a vacant unit. Like, why is it vacant? But by knowing that I was going to get an update on a metric and a scoreboard of where we were at the end of the week, I'm like, okay, I'll wait to Friday. I'm not going to ask questions. If the result is there, then the actions that they're taking are there. Also, I feel very confident that they know that if they do a bad job, it's not just me or the company that's doing a bad job. It's going to impact their pay. And I know that they care about pay. So a really good SOP like ties all those things into one roll up. And I would say, I do want to end with this, Brian, because I think this is really important. When you communicate this to the employee, you tell them that I am very confident that you could get an amazing pay and compensation by following the standard operating procedure that I put together for you. And I want you to do that for at least 3 months. After 3 months, if you can do this and you can get the same kind of results that I was getting, maybe better, but for sure meet the expectation, but you think there's a better way to do it, mm-hmm. I would love you to present that to me. Mm-hmm. I'm open to the conversation after 3 months. If you want to change it, you got to tell me why, and then you got to prove out over the next 30 days how results would be better in either time that it takes you to do it, because that would save you payroll, right? Mm-hmm. Which is good from a profitability standpoint, or the actual result. I like this too, because it just gives that team member more autonomy. And as you start to grow, we've been talking about business architecture. Like when I started, there was only one, we call them legal specialist. Now we have three. So if one person wants to change how they do delinquency, they're not just changing the SOP for themselves, for your future company, right? They're changing it for all three people. When I first started, we only had four rental techs. Now you just heard my operations director say that we have 25 teams of three. If you change one thing in how to remodel a unit, you're changing it for almost 70 team members. Mm-hmm. That's a big change. First of all, we should celebrate if it actually works. But as your business grows, Brian, you also don't want to be the one further advancing your standard operating procedures anymore. You just want to make sure the results are staying where they need to be, if not getting better, because processes, I'm sure you felt this, processes depreciate just like anything else. Mm-hmm. There's process depreciation, but if you really set the autonomy and the compensation to the people doing the processes, they will help, just like real estate, appreciate that process and make it better. Like our delinquency process today, I'm not ashamed to say, is much better than the original SOP I put together. And I'm not doing them anymore. So if you think about that too, as an entrepreneur, you don't need to come up with every single SOP. You need to just come up with the first one for that first thing, have the scoreboard, match the compensation. And I think that just makes the whole thing a lot easier because you only have to do it once. Like you can live with it once. Mm-hmm. And the most brutal thing in that process is probably you slowing the fuck down and being like, okay, what am I even doing for that task, right?
Yeah. It's funny that you say that. So there's a quote that I really like, and I've been, you know, implementing it as much as I can. And when I'm zooming out, I try to think of it. And it's the best games worth playing in life are not winnable. Mm. So it's, you can't win marriage. You can only remain married.
Yeah.
You can't win business. You can only stay in business. You can't win health. You can only remain healthy. So therefore, what you're describing is a giant game.
Yeah.
And the more fun you have playing the game, which we create the rules to summarize what you're saying, like, you're creating a game for everyone to play.
Yep.
And every single person knows the rules of the game. Every single person knows how to win the game and what it looks like to really win the game at a high level. And they know when they're losing the game. Yep. So how do you overcome the emotional side of this?
Yeah.
About the lack of control.
It is, I would honestly say the emotional side is probably way harder than even putting the SOP together. Mm-hmm. But I do think it goes back to what I originally said is that is going to happen. And I think what you have to say is that I am comfortable knowing that this is going to work 80 to 85% of the time. And that one customer is the 15%, right? That I'm just not going to get. But the reason I wanted to hand this process off in the first place is because I wanted to scale and because I wanted to build. And my ability to be able to lose that customer ultimately is a short-term sacrifice for long-term gain. That doesn't help you with the emotional side, but conceptually that makes sense. I'm losing the customer to be able to gain 10 customers because by losing that customer, I freed up X amount of time because I'm not closing and doing 425 calls a year. I have somebody else that's doing it. And maybe he will never be 100%. There's processes within your company that they'll never just do as good as you because that's something that maybe it's your genius or maybe you're as good as it. But I would say there's other processes that they'll do even better than you and they'll surprise you. Maybe not initially, but I think that's how you get over the emotional side is you just look at the factual side of like, I have to lose this customer today because I know that I needed to hand this off and I'm going to gain 10 because of it, because I'm spending my time on stuff that's going to give me a better ROI.
I feel like it makes you feel better when you know that it's like a necessity.
Yeah.
And like that's part of the game. And I like that you phrased it like you're sacrificing one to gain 10.
Yep.
It's like you build the SOP to build the sales team, to be able to build the marketing team to support, right? You have an SOP for people that are even doing the service work.
Yeah.
So walk us through, you have a three step, they only have three steps.
Yeah.
So when a service tech goes in, and this is the difference between you having a 4.9 like customer service rating as opposed to other people that were asking for advice that have a 2.1
yeah.
customer service ratings. Walk us through the three steps that literally changed the entire customer service model of your business.
Sure. I think like the experience that you provide people, right, how people feel is really important. But I also think like when you design a standard operating process, we've just been talking about this, you shouldn't design it for rock stars. You should design it so that anybody can do it. Yeah. I actually think our entire standard operating procedure for service techs, like one of the easiest things is like one of our best procedures in our whole company. So let me answer your question and then I'll take people through like really quickly, like the whole thing. But I was telling Brian, our service techs, right, are scored on four different metrics. And one of them is the experience that they provide the resident. And I was sharing, when you picture a maintenance person or a service tech, this is no offense to anybody, that knows how to fix everything, that is like really good at being able to problem solve and fix something, you don't necessarily picture somebody that is super fun and friendly and is going to give a great experience. Mm-hmm. But these service techs are going into people's homes. There's kids, there's animals, there's all these other things. So a lot of people, to your point, have a very low experience score for their service techs, even if they can fix things really well. So in our SOP, we said, we got to make this simple because these guys have to be still doing their job, but we want to make sure the experience is better. So we said, okay, let's break down what matters most to the person answering the door. So it starts with you knock on the door. And because you should be using a system and the person put in a service request, you should know the person's name. So they should know the name. Let's say I'm the service tech. Brian's the person that needed his garbage disposal fix. I knock on the door. He opens it. I greet him by name. And it's all of, number one is all about the greeting. I force my smile if I have to. And I say, hey, Brian, I heard you put in a service request. I'm here to take care of that for you, as you saw in my previous communication through text, phone call, whatever you're going to use. Would you like me to take my shoes off or put on booties? That's it. Greet them by name. Ask to take their shoes off or put booties on. Then you walk into the unit and you give one compliment. Don't overcomplicate this, guys. If you see a cat, ask what the cat's name is. Say you have a nice cat. If you see a dog, do the same thing. If you see a kid, do the same thing. If there's none of that and you see a picture on the wall, say nice, nice picture. Just give one compliment. So I'm going to give you a compliment. Then that's number two.
I'd like the compliment.
Yes.
Can you give me a compliment?
Yeah, that's a really nice Lululemon shirt you have
on
today.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian. Then you walk past and then you fix the thing that needs to be fixed. And then you get the hell out of there, right? You thank them for their time. Hey, thanks, Brian. It was really nice meeting you here today, or nice dog named Bob, whatever. And you get out. That's it. You keep it really simple. And then just like any SOP, you have to think about why as a service tech would I do that? So we made it simple, but I think it's fair to say that there could be service techs that are still like, no, fuck this. I ain't giving a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
I shouldn't have to give a compliment. That's not part of my job. I'm here to fix it. I think that's a fair thing that you could see us saying.
And if they get annoyed, then they're like, I'm going to leave here anyways for a dollar raise down the street.
Yeah.
Because how many people are listening to this right now, especially in these positions and like some of these thankless jobs, but they're like, it's very difficult to attract people, let alone to keep people.
Yes.
Especially in today's market where all of a sudden you see labor doubling in cost.
Exactly. So we just thought about what are the things that we care about as a company, mm-hmm. and how do we ensure that we made them simple, like I just described with the experience process, but also how do we make sure that the service tech cares as much as we do? And guys, we don't need to overcomplicate this. Like, even if you've never worked in property management, I promise you would name the top things that a service tech would have to do. Do you think we'd care about speed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like when someone puts in a service request, fixing it fast probably matters. Do you think we care about cost? Yeah, that probably matters. Do our service techs, like all of our service techs have budgets that they have to be able to meet. Somebody asked me, how would they, I don't understand. If they can't fix the garbage disposal, they have to call a plumber. If they call a licensed plumber, it's going to cost us 3 times as much. Cost. Quality. Can you imagine going there and fixing your garbage disposal and then it not working and me having to come back there 2 or 3 times? So we got to make sure there's no go backs. And obviously, while we're there, we should provide a great experience so that while we're in somebody's home, we can get in and out and not just fix it, but it's a pleasant experience. Those are things we care about. Mm-hmm. But how do we get the service tech to care about them? Easy. So we think about, all right, one, I could tie that all to his annual raise, which we do. Hey, just so you know, there will be a scoreboard every single week, and we will give you your metric. It's why I told you today that 98% of our service requests in the month of August have been done in 48 hours. We even track 24 hours, 83 within 24 hours, because we're trying to up the bar to 24. Right now, they're incentivized by 48. Okay, we have an actual scorecard. It's why you knew that we're at a 4.9 out of 5 when it comes to experience, because all of our service tech have their individual experience scores. And we know quality and we know cost, and that's reported on a weekly basis. And we take it one step further. Not only will this affect your review, but if you get 100% of your service requests done within 48 hours, we're going to give you a quarter raise for how many units that you manage. So our average service tech can manage 500 units. So now he's going to get 25 cents if he gets them all in. You think he's going to care about speed? Hell yeah. Next, if you have no go backs, if you did it right on quality, we'll give you another quarter. Can you imagine? These guys are 500 units. How many service requests with no go backs? That's amazing. Step three, if you're above a 4.7 in experience, so here's where that comes in. We'll give you another quarter. So now you do want to smile. Now you do want to throw the damn booties on. Now you do want to give that compliment, right? And then last is the cost. Mm-hmm. So did you meet your monthly budget, which will incentivize them to not just quickly call a plumber to fix it so they can meet their speed goal. They're going to problem solve and try to fix it in-house so we can save costs. So they can get a dollar. So that's $500 extra a month on top of what they already make if they meet all four of the things. So they care. Now, here's the best part. Do you think it would be great if our service tech could do 600 units instead of 500?
Mm-hmm.
So we also say, hey, if you meet all four of these metrics for 3 months consistently, we'll make you eligible for more units if you want them to help you get $600 if you meet all four of them instead of five. So now we'll grow your ability to be able to make more, but also it's better for us. We need less service techs because they're covering bigger territories. In fact, our best service tech covers 1,100 units and he crushes it. Makes a ton of money, but he's incentivized to continue to manage more. And by the way, he still has to meet all four of those goals, right? Because you don't want too many units where you can't meet all four of those goals.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of all that, maybe I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I feel like there's a lot to an SOP that we're now advancing to the more advanced version of these, which this is like compensation, training, and development. Like, how do you keep your people?
Oh, this is the application of the SOP.
Yes. Right? Yes. If you want to keep your people and you want to keep growing, the last thing you want to do is lose the person that you just trained to do delinquency or to do a service tech. So you got to think about what do they want next. So for us, we thought about more units, more pay. This will really help them focus in on doing these really well because they can't get more units without more pay. But what about if we could train them and they could become a service tech one, but grow into a service tech two? So if you take on a certain amount of unit counts, if you're in the best 25% of your peer group, we'll now train you with our licensed plumber, our licensed HVAC, our licensed electrician to get you focus certified. So if before, as a service tech one, you could fix a leaky toilet, a garbage disposal, et cetera, when it comes to plumbing, we'll now teach you how to put in a water heater. Instead of fixing an AC, we'll teach you how to fix a furnace. Two things happen there, right? One, less license call outside of the company, saving us money. Two, we educate our team. And three, we would immediately pay them more. So can you think about it if you're a service tech and you're just like chilling? Because this is the worst thing you want. We were talking about this earlier today. Is the last thing you want is a service tech to get really good at their job and start earning their monthly bonus month after month and month. Even if they're the best, you can do shit like we have a traveling trophy. I know in our company, the traveling trophy has really stayed with one guy for a long time. He claims he's going to retire with it. No one's going to take it away. So there's some engagement there. But we need something more for him to look forward to, and we want it to be mutually beneficial. So by training him to be able to do more advanced things, that will save us money, but we'll also pay him more money. By giving him the opportunity to gain more units, that will help us by having one person doing a bigger territory, but also give him more money. So if you think about the best SOPs, the scoreboard is mutually beneficial for both the company and the person. So now as an entrepreneur, you don't need to work so hard. If you didn't have that, can you imagine figuring out different ways to motivate them? I'm just not a big believer in like thinking recognition or having like games. I see a lot of entrepreneurs like, okay, we're going to really rally the service techs this month, and we're going to play like this March Madness game. And like, you all get to be a team, and like, you win this like $250 gift card. Mm-hmm. Games are transactional. Like, they get everybody really excited for 1 month, but what happens after that month? Nothing in life, not a single SOP, should be predicated on a transaction. It should all be based on a system, a relationship that's ongoing. So the best SOPs have that too. Like, how do we make these guys internally motivated to do well that also helps our company do well?
I try to remember back to when I was in my job, because there was a period of my life where I thought that I was going to be 65 years old and SVP of sales, right? Or yeah, like the president of sales, and wearing a suit and tie. And I was excited for that. But then something changed. And then for a lot of people listening, something changed for them because they're a high performer in their job. And then they're all of a sudden was a reason for them to leave and to go do their own thing. So a lot of the times it's lack of upward mobility. You start looking up and you either don't like what you see or that there is no more room, mm-hmm, right? So that's problem number one. Problem number two is if winning even was clearly defined, which in most companies it's not, you don't know what winning is, you start to get taken away from your winning activities. So for me in sales, it was prospecting, presenting, that was it. And if I'm not prospecting and presenting as a sales rep, then I'm not making money. But then all of a sudden I started getting all these extra things, all these political assignments to get my promotion, right? Yeah. And they're like, oh, we want to make you to make PowerPoint slides. We want you to do new rep calls, none of which I was being compensated for.
Yeah.
And then so I grow frustrated. And so that's what you're talking about, is even all the way down to service tech. Like, okay, here's how you know that you're winning every single week. And if you win, here you go. Every single part of it is leading them to the next level, to the next thing. Everyone's always excited and ready to move because their compensation is directly tied to the company's interests.
Yep.
And I love that. So let's go back a little bit. So somebody, if they're still sticking with us at this point, then that means that they're very serious about growing their business. But they may say, and we'll just use the unit count, for instance,
yeah,
just for sake of simplicity. But we'll say, maybe they are at that 10-door mark and they say, okay, Logan and Brian, I hear what you're saying. So every single SOP that I create needs to be created for 1,000 units.
Yep.
How the fuck do I do that?
Yeah.
They're like, I don't know what that takes.
Yeah.
What does 1,000 units require? I can't barely think to 100 units. What do you mean 1,000 units? I don't know what that team looks like. I haven't even hired anyone. I've got a property manager that works for me that kind of moonlights for me.
Yep.
What's your strategy for doing that?
I love this question. And business architecture is all predicated on like how efficient is the system and the person that runs the system. Mm-hmm. But we get confused when you're small, 10 units. Mm-hmm. You know as well as I do, like when we had 4 people, they wear a lot of hats. Okay.
Yeah.
When you're wearing a lot of hats, it gets even muddier. So what you got to figure out is you got to envision how for a specific task or collection of tax. For example, we can talk about either delinquency or service tax. So for service tax, when you have 10 units, and let's just say your service tech can do 500, when you're at 10 units, you need to think about that service tech, by the way, is probably also turning units. Mm-hmm. He's probably a rental tech and a service tech. Like he's getting the units ready, maybe even do the move outs, and he's doing the service requests. Because at 10 units, I mean, you can't afford one guy to do it.
Exactly.
So what you really want to break down though is like at what point, at what unit count will you first separate the task? Like when will you be able to afford one person to turn the units and one person to do the service request? So that's what it means about thinking in advance. You're thinking about an SOP in the future and how much can they possibly do? Delinquency is no different. Like we had one person that can do about 1,500 units. You want to know how? Until she started feeling overwhelmed. When she became overwhelmed with the 1,500 units, we knew, and she could not possibly follow that SOP, we knew we needed to hire another one. Mm-hmm. So then we think about from a business architecture standpoint, now what does this look like? Okay, so 1,500 units. That means we need two for 3,000, right? This is all real numbers, by the way. Mm-hmm. So why I just told you I have a third, and we're only at about going to be about 34, 35. One of the other things you learn about business architecture is it takes a long time to get somebody, like how long will the ramp up be in the training process? So for us, if we know that we need one every 1,500 units, we literally just hired our third one 2 weeks ago because that person is going to benefit from a much lower unit count. Like, think about it, 400 or 500 units versus the 1,500 they can handle. But our service tech is no different. We hire a service tech, their territory is only 100 units, Brian. They don't get the full 500 probably for 12 months until they reach that 13th month, that second time they do the same month. We really want to make sure they know their job, and we slowly allow them to be able to train and grow their specific territory. So I think when you're thinking about like how to exponentially think about 10 units, 100 units, 300 units, 500, I want you to think about, okay, where do I see myself in the next 3 to 5 years? And then how will that role expand? Or how will it be able to double? Like expand means you separate a rental tech from the service tech. But being able to like double is like the delinquency where now we have three people. Mm-hmm. And you're not done there, by the way. Like you have three people. Now you have three legal specialists. When do you need a leader? Like when do you implement a leader? So then you got to think about that too. Like service tech is a good example. We started, like I started the property management company. We had 252 units. Okay. So we only had three rental techs / service tech. So I knew right away they obviously need a boss. So we had an operations leader. Today, we have an operations director, operations leader for just service techs, two for the rental techs, and then we have the team members underneath there. So it's impossible to think of them all, but I would just challenge everybody to think about where do you see yourself in the 3 to 5 years? Whether that's units, social media, business, etc. You can fairly accurately predict where you'll be. And then you can predict, like you said, you built out on an Excel what you will need for that. And mm-hmm. then you just work backwards. Like I didn't know 4 years ago when we hired our first legal specialist for that SOP that she could do 1,500 units because we didn't have 1,500 units. Mm-hmm. But if you're paying attention to it quarterly, semi-annually, and she's still operating at a good pace, you know you need another one. You just don't know how many units. Now the second and the third become a lot easier.
Yeah. And this is where mentors come in too.
Yeah.
Like it's an absolute cheat code because the reason that for what he's alluding to for people listening is my org chart is created for 3 year, like 3 million plus. So that's like another year or two. So that's what we're planning for right now. And the reason I was able to create that org chart was because I followed a guy named Cole Gordon. And so Cole does 20 million a year in his company that's relatively in the similar field as mine.
Yeah.
And so I say, okay, what does he run? Or you go to someone like you where somebody's listening and maybe they have 1,000 units. They're like, oh, what can I do to enter Logan's orbit to see what he's doing?
Yeah.
To be able to pull that org chart so I can immediately see, because no matter what level of business you're at, there's somebody that's a couple steps ahead of you.
Yes.
And then you're just like, what are you doing? What are you building? When did you hire? I wrote down something that I'm going to implement in my business immediately after this. We are going to do a full R2R SOP, which is regular to rockstar.
Yes.
That's what we're going to do.
I love it.
So this is something I'm going to change from this conversation is before I was like, okay, how can I attract rock stars? Only attract rock stars. But how do I make an SOP that's so good that anybody can do it and become a rock star through doing it?
Yes.
And like, I never thought about it like that.
Yes. A lot of people talk about like, it's so hard to find people or keep people. I'm convinced because they're only looking for rock stars. And you said it yourself. Those are unicorns.
Yeah.
So it's so much easier to have a really cool SOP, a really cool training program, an opportunity to develop them and to synchronize compensation. So you're both happy and you both can grow. I like love what you said about your W-2 because obviously the last time we talked, I felt the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for a while, you're really growing your skills and your abilities and your responsibilities, which is great because they can never take that away from you. But as you grow or as you advance, you're not learning as much of those skills and abilities. And maybe some of those turn like political as well too. And I think like big companies forget about that. And so as you're designing these processes, if people are thinking about, are those processes you put in place always going to incentivize or grow people? And are the people that lead them like invested in doing so, and people that you want to model in your company? Like, you don't need to be a rock star to be a good person. And I'm not saying that there is bad people necessarily, but I did what you did. Like, I looked up at places I envisioned myself in my company, and I saw what I didn't want. I saw people that were divorced. I saw people that were working like crazy that didn't have the time. And I'm like, that's not what I want. But I also saw this whole political agenda that really took people away from the results, like you said, too.
If people are listening to this and they're feeling a little overwhelmed right now, it's just know that this is the skill set and the muscle to build.
Yep.
And once it's built, you can build any business.
Yes.
Because if you don't have this, like, why is passive income passive? Because you have somebody else that's actively managing it.
Right.
So the only reason that you can have any semblance of passivity is because you have a team, and the better the SOP and the better the person that's doing that task, the more passivity you have.
Right.
So this skill set is everything.
Yeah. And I think it's funny, Brian, because I hear a lot of people say, yeah, like what you want to do or what you should be doing as a business owner is only focused on vision and strategy and maybe business architecture. And they're right. But if you didn't create the systems are, and you don't have the people operating in them, you're going to be constantly doing all this. There's checks and balances. Mm-hmm. Like, there's got to be scoreboards and things that roll up to you so that you feel that the people that are actively managing your business are actively doing a good job. Mm-hmm. That's my biggest beef with people that want to, like, that have no business creative financing because they have no idea how to run a real estate property or a business, like just jumping into it, because you have no idea the KPIs that you need to follow up with. And a lot of bad things can happen to a lot of good people, or people that want to have never owned a piece of real estate, but they want to syndicate their first 100-unit deal. You don't know how to run a 2-unit deal. What makes you think you can do 100? You're just going to figure that out. There's a lot of things that can go wrong. And unfortunately, it's not just your money at stake too. So like, I think, yeah, like ultimately, that's where you want to be. You want to focus on vision. You want to focus on strategy. You want to make sure that you're thinking and helping your business see that 5 to 10 year plan. But at the same time, like, some of the best business builders in the world, we're talking about the Hormazis for a little bit too, is I promise you, like, they have amazing checks and balances within their business so that when things go wrong, they understand it enough to be able to be like, okay, this KPI is coming in wrong because they have a reporting structure. Mm-hmm. It must be something with the standard operating procedure. Let's dig in. You don't have to dig in on everything, but by creating this stuff, I just think it's really important. And you're right. Like, even if you have 3 to 10 units, like, you don't have to create all these like massive standard operating procedures, or like, you don't have to get like crazy if you're if smaller. Like, I was too. Like, in 2013, 14, 15, by the end of 2015, I owned 7 units. Like, what's easier? You don't need all the SOPs because you only have 7 units. You probably need 3 to 5. You're still going to hold and you're still going to carry a lot of the business. Like, even what you're talking about, like bringing on a closer to take the calls, to be able to close the sales. That's great. But I bet you 3 to 5 years from now, like, especially looking at the org chart that you put together, shit, you're going to need a lot more SOPs. So yeah. If you have one good one right now, that might be all you need. I think some people look at where my business is now and they think, wow, like, he's like super smart and creates 100 SOPs. I did not create 100 SOPs. 4 years ago, I had the 3. That's all I needed. And then the next year, I added another 3 to 4. And as you start adding these, you have other people that are learning how to build them too. So as you grow and as you scale, but where you get wrong is if you never do any.
Yeah.
You never get started.
So this is a really interesting point that I haven't heard you mention. And I'm curious about your perspective on this because, yeah. Oh, sorry about the mic. So what I've heard over and over again, so you mentioned Hormozy's, and so I'm obsessed with them. So I follow him. So his wife, Layla, is actually like the business op. So his wife, Layla, is like you in their business. And so they say that, you know, as much as they want to keep that internal team all the way through, They're like, you have to bring in the outside person that's taking you to the next level to be able to do that. So I'm curious about your perspective on that, because that's been a recurring theme through every single person that I've seen, even interviewing Allie. She said, we had our core group. Yep. We got up to 50 million. Then you have to replace the entire leadership team. I knew that I had to. And she was like, then it was time. So I'm curious about your perspective on that, or versus who to keep internally versus when to bring an outside leader in.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I want to answer two things, that question and also how what you just said and how important it is to keep everybody engaged in what they do and how the Hormozis share wins. Like, I feel like what the Hormozis do with businesses is what I do with real estate. Is if you think about it, like why it's so repeatable and so easy for them is because they just built the systems, right? And Alex is a big part of that, you know, built a lot. For example, the first couple businesses they'll speak to was really hard because you had to teach them how to sell, but now he has a system for selling. Mm-hmm. He has a system for lead. He has a system for offers, not just books, obviously all these systems where it's like really repeatable. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what everybody should do in business. What we've done in real estate is I've built a system so every single apartment is a business. So now that there's these systems, you just buy another business, i.e. an apartment, and you just implement all the systems. It becomes really easy. But also, the best thing that you can do is the visibility of your scoreboards. I just wanted to mention that is because you talked about them sharing wins, like with their portfolio companies. We're sharing wins across our properties, but also the people. Like, for example, that guy, Tony, that keeps winning the trophy. When he wins, when he's the service tech of the month, the whole company knows that. Mm-hmm. So he might never see a rental tech, but the rental tech has heard of Tony. Like the only times he sees him as a, so I don't want to, I just think what you said, I just didn't want to underplay it. And obviously I respect the Hormozis so much, but I think the continuing engagement and making that scoreboard not just visible to you, but your entire company, it highlights the people winning, but don't forget, it also highlights the people losing. Mm-hmm.
And you see everyone else winning.
And if they're who you want on your team, guess what they'll do? They'll call the person winning and ask what the hell they're doing. And if they're the person you don't want, they will affect your culture and you'll have to fire them. But either way, like it identifies like the person you either want on your team and they're going to get better, or the people that you don't. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. I just want to mention that because I think like what they are doing with businesses is literally how I've designed my company with real estate in a lot of different respects. And I respect that a lot. Now, I do want to say, because what you didn't say, and we're getting into here from a leadership standpoint, I've actually heard both of them say this. And I think while Alex gives Layla rightfully a lot of the credit from the operations side and the CEO to even say CEO, he has admittedly said he's developed his own leadership considerable amount. Mm-hmm. And so has she. And I just would say, I just think there's a lot of business owners. You don't have to be in real estate, could be in business, can be in social media. But if you really want to scale and you want to grow, it's not just about the systems. It's about being a good boss to your team. Part of the reasons people come disengaged is not because you're just like sharing information. It's because that boss hasn't become invested in that person. Yeah. Or we just said that boss isn't somebody that you wanted to be. Mm-hmm. Like we both said that with our W-2. So you should be really conscious of that. Like they can be really good at their job, but a great leader leads both a great life that people aspire to become, but also cares about their employee, and that helps with engagement. So
you
have
a vision big enough to fit everyone in.
Exactly. So I like what you said. So I think that I personally believe that I think you just said it, there's a million ways to make $1 million. Mm-hmm. I would never fire and my entire leadership team, my entire internal leadership team to be able to grow. I would absolutely hire people with experience that my leadership team doesn't have to help us be able to grow, to complement, or to bring in some other aspect that would push them to make them better. And one of my general rules is how I develop or how we have brought in people is that, like, for example, besides my president, my next level in my property management company is directors. I will never promote somebody to the director level team that I don't feel has the potential to be the best director on my team. Mm-hmm. So now every new leader, and then underneath them, we have leaders. And we just promoted somebody to be a leader. We always hire externally or promote internally. The bar is they have to have the potential or immediately be better than all the other leaders there. So if you are doing that and constantly bringing in people that raise the bar, not just complementary, but actually raise the bar, I do believe that you can grow more systematically by bringing in those people at the right times. I also balance that with consultants outside. Mm-hmm. So for example, we have a leadership coach who is certified, who is just amazing, and he'll help us design different leadership activities to be able to advance my entire leadership team. Because mm-hmm. my hope is a lot of the leaders that might be at this certain level, I can continue to grow them higher, higher. Now, do I believe that that some of them are going to always be really good at their job, but never reach or have this potential? Absolutely. It's a fact. Mm-hmm. So that's where, as you grow, you want to be able to bring in those people. And Brian, you want to be really honest about your business architecture and your org chart. So we do a year-end meeting every single year with the president, the directors, and myself. Mm-hmm. And this year we shared with them our 10-year plan. And right now our business, it looks a little different than this, but generally we really only have president, directors, leaders, and team members. Mm-hmm. There might be a senior leader or a trainer, but let's just picture that for a second, okay? So we shared a 10-year goal that will be at 25,000 units. And there was a new level in the pyramid, VPs, mm-hmm. which was in between the president and the directors. And what we shared transparently is obviously it'd be amazing if all of our directors, some of them will probably watch this episode, can develop and become a VP. But these VPs have to have these type of things. And right now, like we share this, we don't feel that we have any director that can be a VP of where you currently sit. So we have two options. By the time we're ready to add a VP, you will either have grown your leadership and your capabilities and just be absolutely fucking crushing, not only this company, but probably, honestly, we want our VPs to be the best in the world. Mm-hmm. If you are one of
my... You can afford it now too.
Exactly. That's great if you can become that. But if you can't, it's fine. But we're going to hire somebody externally for that position that has the experience to be the best in the world. So maybe all those VPs will be hired externally. Maybe none of them will. Most likely some of them will. Mm-hmm. And that's what we've done. Like at the leader level, director level, and eventually VP level, which I don't think we'll need any for maybe probably our first one in 2 years from now. Mm-hmm. I think that is a cool way to be able to grow. So if you think about what I just said, how do you grow them internally? How do you use consultants externally to help advance, get compliment? And then nothing against the story that you just said, I would never get rid of my entire team, but I might add a different layer that would then bring in different people.
Yeah. So I wanted to add some context and color to that because, and this is actually something that you could probably give really good advice on as well. So when you first start a company, like the issue that they ran into specifically to provide context to that was when they launched Gym Launch, the people that they had on their team were the people that they could just have. And then Alex and Layla grew. And then once they were at this new level and ready to take on this new challenge, they were like, the rest of the people didn't catch up.
Yep.
And so they were like, these people that were with us from the beginning, we should have let go a long time ago.
Yeah.
And we didn't, because there are OGs. What's some advice that you can give on, you're saying a lot of internal development, but what if somebody that is one of the original players is not along for the ride?
Hey, real quick, if you're still listening to today's episode, I'm assuming you got value from it, so I need your help specifically. My 2-year vision with this show is to help over 1 million people do what they want, when they want, with who they want, and I can only do that with your help. There are two main ways that a podcast grows. One is through ratings and reviews, and the other is word of mouth. If you could please leave me a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, as well as send this to 1 or 2 friends that you think would get value from it, we can reach the people that we're looking to reach. Thanks in advance. Talk tomorrow.